Engeguem aquesta segona i darrera jornada del... Se sent?
Sí.
De l'Escola d'Estiu de l'Institut de Medi Ambient, la 15a Escola d'Estiu sobre serveis dels ecosistemes. I aquest matí, tal com ahir a la tarda, tractarem casos d'estudi i començarem amb la Anne Brouwer. I ara ja passo al castellà. Anne és professora investigadora sènior i professora de la Universitat de Lincoln en Nueva Zelanda, con la qual des de la Universitat de Girona hemos establecido una col·laboració a través d'un programa internacional, un Erasmus Mundus, en el que havia 8 universitats, 4 europees i 4 asiàtiques i oceàniques. I gràcies a aquest programa, Emma i jo i molts altres doctorandos o postdocs tuvimos la oportunidad de ir a Lincoln, una temporada de entre 6 meses y 3 años, según el alumno. Y fruto de eso, pues de un trabajo conjunto entre Anne y Emma, que ya también expuso ayer, pues bueno, surgió el interés de invitar a Anne a la escuela y ella aceptó, y muy agradecidos. Hacer medio planeta para venir a una, bueno, todo, digamos, toda la vuelta casi, ¿no? Para venir, pues es mucho. Anne trabaja en el Departamento de Gestión Ambiental de la Universidad de Lincoln, tiene un PhD en Environmental Science, Policy y Management por la Universidad de Berkeley en California, también tiene dos Master's Degrees en ciencia forestal de la Universidad de Yale y otro en ciencias políticas de la Universidad de Berkeley. Su especialidad es política ambiental, especialmente en relación a tierras de propiedad nacional o estatal y los recursos naturales en Estados Unidos, Australia y Nueva Zelanda. Sus intereses teóricos se centran al entorno de la política de la tierra y la intersección entre propiedad, entre leyes, legislación de la propiedad, economía y ciencias políticas. Es autora de un libro que en Nueva Zelanda ha sido muy conocido, que se llama Who Owns the High Country, que estimuló un debate a nivel de Nueva Zelanda sobre los procesos aún que ocurren aún en la isla del sur, en que una reforma de la tierra está transformando los paisajes hasta ahora propiedad de la corona o propiedad pública en paisajes también con actividades privadas. Y bueno, a partir de aquí su presentación, que será en inglés por una cuestión práctica de mejor comunicación.
Okay. Thank you. And I apologize for speaking in English. If I ever speak too quickly, please just let me know and I will slow down. There is something different about the light in New Zealand's high country. It makes the details of topography so crisp as to appear fake or somehow digitally enhanced. On a clear day, it's easy to think that you've just stepped out of Plato's cave. The world used to be 2 dimensions, and now suddenly it's 3. And on a cloudy day, Aslan and his friends from Narnia are surely not far away. But the high country landscapes are changing from vast expanses of government-owned land to private subdivisions and viticulture and more subdivisions. The land reform that I will be talking about has a history. So I'll first talk about the history, and then I will talk about the beginnings of a hedonic model that Emma and I have worked on together. So to start with, since 1856, this land has been owned by the Crown. And when I say the Crown, I mean the New Zealand government. So the land we're talking about is here. It runs the length of the South Island. It's the eastern side of the Southern Alps, the mountain chain. It's 2.4 million hectares, which is 10% of the land mass of the country. It's also about the size of Belgium or Israel, so it's quite a lot of land. This land has been owned by the New Zealand government, but leased to pastoral sheep farmers since 1856. Those leases are governed by the Land Act, a piece of legislation that governs all land in New Zealand. And the Land Act says that this land can only be used for pastoral purposes, so sheep farming. And the Land Act also gives several property rights to the leaseholders, those who hold the leases. So the Land Act says that the leaseholder has exclusive rights over the pasturage. So no one else can graze sheep on that land. It's exclusive. Also, the leases are perpetually renewable, which means that they can be renewed at the end of the term. And the terms run for 33 years. So they're very long leases, but they give very narrow property rights. So the Land Act also says what the leaseholders cannot do. They cannot disturb the soil, and they will never acquire the fee simple. And fee simple is a legal term. It means freehold. It means private property. And subdivision is strictly prohibited. There's no industrial development. As you can see, if you cannot disturb the soil, there's not very much that you can do with that piece of land. So these rights to the leaseholders are quite strong, and they last for a long time, but they're very narrow. In 1992, this started to change. The Minister of Lands and Conservation started a reform process to divide these high country leases such that land generally above 1,000 meters in elevation would go into conservation, so national parks, recreation areas, other types of land managed by New Zealand's Department of Conservation. And here I should say that New Zealand's Department of Conservation holds and manages about one-third of the country. It's about half of the South Island. So they already quite a lot of New Zealand is in conservation land. And this land reform is expanding that conservation land. So land above 1,000 meters that has identified landscape values like rare plants, or wildlife, or landscape views, recreational values, that land will go to conservation, and land capable of commercial development, generally close to the roads, close to the lakes and rivers, and below 1,000 meters in elevation, that land gets privatized. It goes to freehold. And so the people who used to lease the land now will own part of the land. For a long time, this transaction was viewed as win-win, as both sides benefited. Both recreation and conservation and the farmers benefited. And has anyone drunk wine from New Zealand, a Pinot Noir? Chances are that that wine came from this land. So until before 1990, there was very little land in viticulture, and quite a lot of the land came out of this land reform.
So in this transaction, because the property rights are quite strong, when the Crown purchases the land to go into conservation, the government must buy those rights from the leaseholder. And similarly, when the leaseholder buys the freehold, buys the private property rights, he must pay the Crown, pay the government for those rights. And over the last 25 years, the Crown, the government, has purchased rights to 330,000 hectares for $116 million. And in euros, that's about 75 million, about. And at the same time, the leaseholders have purchased private rights to 370,000 hectares, so slightly more, for half of that money, so $61 million. And if you think to yourself right now, oh, I'm confused, I don't understand what she's saying, you actually do understand. So just... So to give you an idea, except for Sergi and Emma, has anyone been to New Zealand? Okay, well, there's a very beautiful place called Wanaka, where there are ski resorts and a beautiful lake, and lots of walking tracks. And it's a huge lake. It's 15, 20 kilometers long. And it used to be surrounded by these pastoral lease land. So there was a town, and then the rest of the lakefront was all sheep. Since the 1990s, the Crown has done this land reform such that, in total, they have conserved about 5,000 hectares and privatized just under 20,000 hectares. And in the exchange of money, the Crown paid the leaseholders about $250,000. And again, if you think, oh, I missed something, perhaps my English skills are not as good as I thought. No, your English skills are perfect. It's rather surprising, or I found it rather surprising, that the money went towards the leaseholders. I thought surely the freehold is worth more than leasehold, especially when you've got three to four times as much land. So I thought surely the money would go from the leaseholders to the Crown, but that's not what happened. So for about 15 years, very few people knew anything about this. It was very quiet. And then in 2006, I started looking into it on a Fulbright grant. And what I found was surprising, that the money had gone in the wrong direction. And that caused a bit of consternation. There was quite a lot of angst amongst farmers. Farmers did not want others to know that they were getting a lot of money. And it was a cover story on the lead news magazine. And then at that time, the government signed a land reform deal on a place called Richmond Station, which is on Lake Tekapo. And there, they privatized 6,000 hectares and conserved 3,500. And again, the government paid the new owner of these 6,000 hectares $300,000. And that included 9 kilometers of shoreline on this lake.
So it's rather beautiful land. And that time, that was the first time that this number was public. So up until then, the government classified these prices. So no one could know how much money the government was paying in each of these deals. And at this time, all of a sudden, the interest groups said, hang on, there's something wrong here. And the environmentalists had always been in favor of this because they were getting more conservation land, more recreation access. And so that was good for them. But now that this became, it became more obvious what was happening, they said, stop. Moratorium. We don't want any more of this. And the farmers had always said, this is a land grab, that they are stealing our land, it's terrible. But once the environmentalists said stop, the farmers said, oh, no, keep going, please keep going. It's win-win. And we tried to understand why this would be happening and why the government would be losing money while selling land. And at the beginning of the process, before the government sells the land, they do 2 things. First of all, they hire valuers to estimate the value of the land, and they hire ecologists to go find ecosystem services and landscape values in the land to identify conservation values that should be conserved in conservation land. So we looked at the valuation documents to see why the money would have gone in this direction. And in this lease, they divided the land into different zones, and the lakefront, there was 9 kilometers of lakefront, and the valuers said that the most valuable possible use of the land, of that lakefront, was deer farming for venison. And obviously the value of deer farming is not terribly different to the value of sheep farming. So therefore, the difference between pastoral leasehold and freehold was $78 per hectare. So therefore, the Crown sold the freehold private property for $78 per hectare. And then, of course, a year later, the new owner got consent to subdivide. If I'm happy to take questions as we go along, if there are questions. And I'm happy to, I can understand Spanish, I just don't speak it very well. So Emma and I have been looking at the values that the ecologists have identified on this land. And as you can see, there are nearly 100 different types of values that fall into different categories. So botanical, or plants, and animals, and those types of landscape values. And we have been looking at different we have been looking at those values and observing whether those values influence the prices paid by the government, and also the prices paid for the land after it becomes private. So after it is privatized, it has a different value. So first is just an examination of the sort of net benefits to the government of each of these deals. So on the y-axis, the vertical axis, you have net money coming to the crown. So net dollars coming to the crown. You can see the zero is up there. So the vast majority of these deals, the crown loses money. And then on the horizontal axis, you can see how much land the conservation gained. So the top right quadrant is the clear, it's the best quadrant for the crown because they gained money and they gained land. And you can see that there is one dot in that category. In these two quadrants, whether they're good or not depends on your values. So here, the crown gained land, but lost money. And up there, they lost money, but lost land, but gained money. So either of those could be okay, depending on your values. It's this quadrant that is quite troubling, because they lost land and lost money. And as you can see, there's quite a lot of dots in that category. The blue and the red and the black colors relate to different governments, so over time. There's not much of a statistical relationship there, but maybe in the future there will be. So that's just an overview of the land reform. But the hedonic modeling that Emma and I are starting, what we have done is looked at the prices paid for freehold land after privatization. So while the land is owned by the government, you cannot subdivide, you cannot develop, you cannot do anything, you cannot disturb the soil. Once you are allowed to disturb the soil, all of a sudden, the land becomes much more valuable because you can subdivide, you can do lots of other things. So Emma, mostly Emma, I helped a little bit, but over many months of this year, we had this map of land prices, and we superimposed on that map the old boundaries of the leases. So what we wanted to discover is what land was previously owned by the crown and what has happened to it since then. So has it sold? What value does it have now? And so it involved a very painful process of pointing and clicking on about 3,000 separate individual parcels of land to discover whether they have sold, how much it sold for, and what its government estimated value is. So as you can see, or as you can imagine, pointing and clicking and copying and pasting on 3,000 parcels of land took a long time. So we've only just started the analysis. What we found is that the high country landscapes have changed quite a lot. Here you can see it's the same parcels of land that we saw before. These dark pink boundaries are parcels that have sold. So they have sold on the open market. Of about 3,000, so 20 years ago, the 3,000 parcels that we were looking at were about 100 parcels. So it's gone from 100 parcels to 3,000 parcels. Of those 3,000 parcels, only about 200 have sold.
So very little of them, very few of them have sold. And the mean price is almost $400,000, so about 250,000 euros. If you compare the prices, the crown selling price, so the price the government sold the land at, to the price paid on the open market, on average, when the farmer sells land, sells private land, he sells it for 493 times how much the crown sold it for, or how much he purchased it for. So he purchased it for $100,000, and he sold it for 49 million, I think. Anyway, 493 times. He purchased it for $1, and he sold it for $493. And that's adjusted for inflation. So New Zealand does not have rampant inflation. And so what Emma and I have been doing, working on, is looking at those ecosystem values that the ecologists identified before the government divided up the land. And we have been looking at whether there is an association, a correlation, between the presence of ecological values and price. So does land sell for more if it has these values? And so we've done a linear regression, including lots of different values. And what we were trying to do is compare agricultural values to environmental or amenity values to see which is more important in land prices. And the data that we used was both spatial and financial. So we used those ecologist-identified landscape values. We also used published agricultural values that measure or estimate the agricultural productivity of land by class. Emma classified land by distance to these southern lakes. They're quite beautiful lakes. And also estimated whether the parcels had a view of the lake. So not just the distance, but the view. And what we found is that by far the most influential factor in price is size. So the smaller the parcel of land, the higher the value. So very small parcels, 1/4 of a hectare, next to a lake, near a ski resort of Queenstown or Wanaka, obviously those are the most valuable. The 5,000 hectare farm, far from a lake, far from a town, obviously will be the lowest value land. The other thing, reassuringly, we found that most of the coefficients had the expected sign, that productivity is important and amenity values are important. What we found that was a little bit more surprising, though, was that the amenity values, so the landscape values identified by the ecologists, views of lakes, distance to lakes, those seem much more significant than the agricultural values. So although the crown, the government, might be assigning value based on agricultural productivity, when the land sells on the open market, it's the amenity values that
are selling for. Also interesting is that these landscape values identified by the government ecologists has a coefficient of 0.6, and it's significant. So, I mean, it's a much higher coefficient than we were expecting to find. And it suggests that the government is very good at identifying landscape values, but they're less good at keeping those landscape values. So, because if land has landscape values, according to the law, it should get conserved. It shouldn't be sold. But when it gets sold, those landscape values command a high price. Distance to lake is also, not surprisingly, a very significant factor in price. So we're just at the beginning of our hedonic modeling, and we would very much welcome any suggestions that you have. This land reform in New Zealand has been going for 25 years. It's not a terribly good policy. It doesn't have terribly good results for the environment, but it does have terribly good results for farmers. So it benefits farmers far more than it benefits the public or the environment. But there you have it, it continues. So I'm happy for any questions, and feel free to ask in Spanish.
Thank you for your presentation. My question is about the values assigned by the ecologists, because you confronted the values from farmers and the values from amenities. And what about how much values from the ecologists have been losing? Or are you working also on this comparison or on identifying also this aspect? Or
What percentage of the land with identified values the government kept versus
in this map you said that these are the values assigned by the ecologists. So supposedly I imagine the capacity to provide services.
Identified, not assigned, but they discovered okay. Values on this land. Yes.
Are you working to verify or to verify if there are some relationship or what of these identified values has been lost? Are you working also at this point?
Yes. Well, one of the things that I would like to do is look at, remember how I said
yes.
The blue dots and the red dots are not statistically significant when it comes to price. But what I would like to do is, instead of using price as the vertical axis, use percentage of or success at conserving values as the vertical axis, and see if different governments are better at conserving values than other governments. Because I didn't show this slide, but the government is not very good. Oh, maybe I don't have it. Oh, I didn't show it because I don't have it. The government conserves, well, last time we looked, the government conserved about 30 or 40% of identified values. And the identified values very high, we conserve the vast majority. The identified values in the lowlands we're not very good at conserving.
And neither any reflection on the matrix in itself and how this land works from the point of view of landscape ecology, for example. Mm. If you just conserve, that it was nice to have this line of 1,000 meters of altitude. So to say, from here on we conserve, and the rest we can just sell or just change.
Right.
This is interesting, but there is no ecological thoughts behind this.
Well, there's a little. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. It's not always 1,000 meters. Okay. Often it's about that, but it's a lot more nuanced than that. But like you say, it's they're not very good. They do these negotiations one by one. So they do not think of, oh, we would like to create a whole national park. And so let us put together an entire landscape that we will conserve. No, because they just do this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and there's no relationship between them. So no, there is some ecological logic in it, but I think that it's much more political logic than ecological, and even economic logic, because if they were following the values of property rights, the government would have made money, not lost money. And if they were following ecological values, they would have conserved. There wouldn't be any, like here, you can see that's a vast area of some ecological value that has been privatized and sold. If they were following ecological values, that wouldn't exist.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation. I'm sorry because I lost the beginning, but I have a question. For the New Zealand government, what is the final purpose? Maybe you already explained it. The final purpose to sell this land, I mean, is to answer the farmers' lobby pressure, is to make money, because I... as I follow, there's no logical, ecological, economically reason to do that.
That's a very good question, and no, I didn't explain it because I don't really know. It's certainly not to make money, because they didn't. I think the big part of it is that while this land was under pastoral lease, most of the economic capacity of it was locked. You couldn't grow grapes. You couldn't subdivide. You couldn't grow fruit, or you couldn't irrigate. And so they wanted to unlock that commercial potential. Also, there's an ideological goal in that state ownership of land in the 1990s was not viewed as a good thing. The government should not own land. Well, not according to me, but according to the ideology of the time. And it's still quite prominent. So there was an ideological goal. Also, the environmentalists, so the hunters and the recreational lobby and the green environmental groups, they wanted the sheep off of the high country. So land above 1,000 meters is too fragile to have sheep on. So they wanted recreational access and sheep out. And so to them, that was a good thing. And the farmers wanted freehold, of course. And so everybody wanted it. And so the Crown said, okay. And the Crown thought, well, government owning land is a bad thing. So that's how it happened. It doesn't make much sense, though. You're right.
Hi. Three questions. One, which is the specific weight of the farmers? They make a lot of the money income in relationship to the whole country? Or just where is their weight real on the economy? And which one is their power? Second is, what happened after the publication of your book? And third is, if you are working on one governance or any kind of alternative to all that mess. Thank you.
First of all, the economic power of the farmers now is not very great because wool prices are not as strong as they used to be. Traditionally, historically, the high country farmers were very powerful economically and politically, and now they have a social status that is far stronger than their economic status. So there's quite a lot of myth, cultural myth. All the beer commercials in New Zealand are about the southern man, which is this high country farmer. About half of the coffee table books, so picture books that you see of New Zealand, are of this land. So it's very, even though their economic power is not great, their social and cultural power is very, very strong. After the publication of the book, the Labour government was still in power, so those were the red dots that you saw. And they did change the policy. They didn't stop it, but they changed it such that land within 5 kilometers of a lake would not be privatized. But then, about a year after that, a new government came in and they revoked that. And then the third question was, alternatives? I mean, I think there's a lot of better ways to do it. I mean, first of all, I think leaving it in lease would be a fine way to go, because sharing use rights can be a very good way to manage a landscape. It might not be the most economically productive, so it might well lock up certain productive capacity, but it's a good way to, a very effective way to manage a landscape or to maintain and conserve social and cultural values in a landscape. I think sharing and overlapping property rights is a very effective way to maintain that. But if you are going to privatize, you should, or the Crown should set up the negotiations differently. They should sell it on the open market first, so that the land that has sold for in total $300 million. But the Crown, the taxpayer, realizes none of that benefit. But if the Crown just sold it outright, then at least we would get the revenue, and we could use that revenue to maintain conservation land from pests and things like that. So yeah, if you're going to do it, there are far better ways to do it.
Well, thank you, Anne, for a very interesting presentation. I have a couple of comments, and they are related to the actual effects that this land reform has had in landscape, because you have demonstrated a distributive issue, that there is this money going into private hands. But after this, and since there has been a period of since this started, there have been actual changes, because in the we have currently a discussion on the models of conservation that you can adopt, and in the past, this area that is now under conservation was actually managed for pastoralist purposes, and this, I mean, is well known that pastoralism has effects, ecological effects, but it was good enough to create these new beautiful landscapes that you've shown, no? So the new private areas may have been, or now maybe under the same use. So they will remain as beautiful as they were, but only, let's say, with more with a higher diversity in activities. This I don't know. I mean, it's just a question. And then another comment is, yes, there is this distributional issue that the state is the crown is transferring money to these farmers, but you may, you know well that here in Europe there is this program of, let's say, paying the farmers for preserving the... So this can be seen, to an extent, as a way of, let's say, compensating for the for the maintenance of rural landscapes. Of course, in New Zealand you have so many, but in here it's actually well seen by the, let's say, society as a whole, because they are, or the farmers are preserving the rural landscapes. So is this, let's say, relevant in the New Zealand context?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you make a very good point that the before the reforms, the pastoralists were managing the landscapes. And sheep can be quite hard on very high altitude land, but they do control weeds. And weeds are a big problem in New Zealand. If there had never been any sheep, then weeds would not be a problem, but it is. And so now hundreds of thousands of hectares have shifted to conservation, and the Department of Conservation doesn't have the capacity to manage the weeds as carefully as the farmer might have. I mean, not all farmers did, but some did. So I think there is something lost there. And the new freehold land, much of it is not, does not look like it did before. It's in viticulture. They're vast, sort of south of a certain point. There's grapes everywhere, and grapes are beautiful in their own way, but it's a very changed landscape. In one area, it's changing all to dairy. So they're irrigating. So the hills used to be brown, and then now they're becoming green because of irrigation. So yeah, I mean that sharing of property rights and the sharing of landscape management, I think, can be quite a good way. And I think that I think you're right. There's something lost when we give that up. It's here they are paying farmers to maintain that. In New Zealand, they're doing just the opposite. Thank you.